That jarring cacophony tells you that yet again you're listening to the Power of Three podcast, the Scottish Doctor Who podcast that just keeps churning out those episodes. I'm Kenny Smith. You might know me from Big Finish's Vortex magazine, but you might not. But hey, it doesn't matter if you do or if you don't, as long as you're here and ready for some Doctor Who fun, because that's what we're all about. And again, we're turning our eye to the Doctor Who novels featuring the 10th Doctor. And today, we're taking a look at Wooden Heart, that was the 15th novel in the BBC New Series Adventures range. It was written by Martin Day and featured the 10th Doctor and Martha Jones, and was published on the 19th of April, 2007. So, what does the back cover blurb have to tell us? The Castor, a vast spaceship seemingly deserted, spinning slowly in the void of deep space. Martha and the Doctor explore the drifting tomb and discover that they may not be alone after all. Who survived the disaster that overcame the rest of the crew? What continues to power the vessel? And why has a stretch of wooded countryside suddenly appeared in the middle of the craft? As the Doctor and Martha journey through the forest, they find a mysterious fog-bound village. A village traumatised by missing children and tales of its own destruction. Ooh, there's an exciting tease for you. An audiobook of this novel was released on the 2nd of July 2007, and it was read by Martha's mum, played by Adjo Ando on TV, of course. And it was also released as an audiobook for the RNIB and read by Tim Bruce, but I don't know much more about it than that. I just know it exists. It might be a full version, given that the audiobook read by Adjo Ando was actually a cut-down version. Anyway, let's hear a quick clip from that and hear what Adjoa has to say.
They trudged along for some considerable time, Martha desperate to spot something she recognised from their first appearance in the woods that morning. But it was dark now, the trees reaching around and over her like suffocating shadows, and it was all she could do to keep her feet from stumbling over hidden roots and broken branches.
"We're almost there," said Saul suddenly, as they came into a clearing.
"Yes!" exclaimed Martha suddenly, pointing to a small stump a distance away. It resembled a squashed teddy bear. "I remember this bit."
The silence of the dark forest was suddenly split asunder. Someone was screaming at the top of their voice. A child.
"Come on," said the Doctor, already at Saul's shoulder and running at his side.
Within moments, they found themselves in another small open space between the trees. The floor of the clearing was covered with moss and tiny brambles, and in the centre crouched a girl in pale blue robes.
"Jude!" exclaimed Saul, running forward. "What are you doing out here?"
The girl struggled against Saul's embrace, pointing in terror as a vast creature pushed its way into the clearing. It moved with surprising grace for all its bulk, hugging close to the ground. Martha gulped. It was the creature they had glimpsed when Saul had freed the Doctor from the iron trap. It had an emaciated, lizard-like face and body, and huge bat wings. Its legs tapped against the ground when it paused, as if it were feeling its way towards its prey. Arched above its head was a great, spiked tail. Before anyone could shout a warning, the tail came smashing downwards, right into the centre of the clearing where Saul and Jude sat. Saul moved his daughter to one side and himself to the other, just as the bony spikes thudded into the decayed tree trunks beneath them. The rotting wood shattered, sending splinters high into the air. Jude went running immediately towards the Doctor and Martha, but Saul stood his ground. A sword in each hand now, he crossed the blades in front of his face, as if daring the beast to come closer. He twisted his head to one side.
"Look after Jude!"
The tail came down again, glancing off an upright tree. Saul was taking no chances, leaping into the air like a gymnast, then running through two of the creature's legs. He arced his swords upwards as he ran, both bit deep into the creature's flesh.
Then he positioned himself behind the creature where he could not be seen.
Run!
He shouted, risking a great cut to the creature's rump while avoiding its feverishly flailing tail. The monster was swinging round in an attempt to bring its great snapping jaws into play, its attention entirely focused on Saul.
Come on,
breathed the doctor, holding Jude's arm and almost pushing Martha out of the clearing. I think it's this way.
We can't just leave him,
shouted Martha, half-turning.
We're not going to leave him, exclaimed the doctor.
They were some metres behind the clearing now, and he stopped suddenly. Facing the many-legged creature, he pulled the sonic screwdriver from his pocket, adjusted the settings with nimble fingers, and held it high in the air. The end of the screwdriver glowed brightly, and Martha heard a shrill whine, which ascended in pitch and soon became completely inaudible. But a moment later, its effect on the monster was all too clear to see. It ceased its attack on Saul, its scaly head turning towards the doctor.
When I say run, the doctor breathed as the monster scuttled towards them.
He turned to find himself on his own, Martha and Jude thundering down a natural path between the trees.
There we go, that's our intro for it. So, this book, what's it like? I enjoyed it, really good read, as always. The BBC pick writers perfectly, who are able to capture the spirit of the series, the zeitgeist, if you will. And it's a great setting, the fact you've got a spaceship, and then all of a sudden, you find there's a forest on board, and you think, this seems a little familiar. Of course, it does from a 2024 point of view, when you think of The Time of Angels and Flesh and Stone. Did Stephen Moffat read these books? I have no idea. Anyway, it's an amazing image, and it absolutely sticks in the mind. And I had completely forgotten this because I did remember thinking, watching the Angel story, this seems familiar somehow, and now I know why. But great book, really good characterisation. Martha is absolutely on the money. Some great moments, particularly when Martha decides to stay behind, when the Doctor is going to close down the link with the outside world from the forest. And there's that moment of, no. Martin absolutely captures that human side to her. And it's a very good story with some great imagery, particularly towards the end. And there's some very interesting stuff, but I'm not going to spoil that for you. In fact, we'll just let Martin spoil it for you himself, because here's the author.
Yes, so I'm Martin Day, and I wrote Wooden Heart.
You'd written for Virgin, you'd written for the BBC Books range before. So how did it come about to join the gang with the new series adventures?
I think I was asked. I think it was as simple as that. I don't recall if I pitched some. I mean, I suppose I was still pitching. Yeah, I guess. But I was asked. I think at that point, because it was, you know, about to be newly on television, I have a strange sense that the fact that I had a young family helped. And for some strange reason, they felt, Justin, whoever actually made these decisions, felt that, you know, having a family of my own might actually help me write a book that was, felt tonally in the ballpark that Doctor Who was going to be, as it was going to be on the screen. So, yeah, I think actually me having two girls who were young enough to be watching it for the first time and obviously really getting into it, I think that probably helped. So maybe that was part of the reason behind the commission.
Brilliant. So do you recall if you were given a brief, or was that some of the other authors have said they had to submit three pitches to Justin and he picked his favourite from them?
I was given a brief in as much as, and I was thinking about this last night, because the books were coming out in sort of groups of three at this point, weren't they? And I've got a feeling that most of the groups of three, certainly at this point, were, there was a science fiction one, there was a historical one, and there was a contemporary Earth one. And I really wanted the contemporary Earth one because that kind of just worked for me. I wouldn't have minded the historical one because I'd done some books of that sort before. And I was really not fussed about, other than obviously you always say yes to Doctor Who, I was least fussed about the science fiction one. And then Justin, it must have been, said, it's going to be the science fiction one, can you pitch into that space? So I said, of course, fine. And so, in a sense, the brief was simply to do the science fiction one. There was nothing more sophisticated, nothing more clever than that. And I think really what happened was, you can see me in a way both, I think, embracing it and pulling away from it, trying to think, okay, I've got the science fiction one, what else can I do with it? I know, I'll make it into a kind of a quasi fantasy thing. And that's essentially what I'm doing, although I think the introductory bit and the underpinnings are obviously quite straightforwardly sci-fi. I think I'm sort of desperately trying to tell something slightly different.
When I think about this book, the thing that struck me before I picked it off the shelf to reread it was a spaceship with a jungle inside it. And then, of course, years later, Stephen Moffat pretty much did the same sort of thing with The Time of the Angels.
Yes, yes. I mean, ultimately, it's a book that's, I don't know if it had influence on anything else. I certainly wouldn't say that, but it wears its influences quite strongly. And I think it's very influenced by even the Doctor Who I'd seen at that point. You know, the new Doctor Who, the new Russell's revamp of it all. So, yeah. And I think it's just a very blunt attempt to shove different things together. So you have, and I thought it would be just fun to have the forest not even being on the ship, sort of silent running style, but actually to be literally smashed together, you know, and find a way of doing that, find a way of telling this slightly fantasy story, but with straightforward science fiction trappings. And then obviously I'm also leaning into it's kind of the same story in some ways as Planet of Evil, which was one of my favourite stories growing up. And then, you know, obviously I was much more aware of Planet of Evil well before Forbidden Planet, for instance. But then the idea of Forbidden Planet, this sort of, which is also Planet of Evil, this sort of projection that is something bad, but it's all the negative thoughts or whatever. So I'm literally stealing, borrowing that idea.
Paying homage, Martin.
Paying homage, absolutely. I'm very much, yeah, leaning into that genius idea of stealing. Yeah.
So were you given a preview of the Doctor and Martha in action? Did you get to see episodes before they were aired?
What I got for this one was three relatively random scripts from the first Martha series. So, and I don't think I saw any of the... No, I'm pretty sure I didn't see advanced screenings of the episodes. So I think I had to go on the scripts. And I think it was obviously the first one. It was Gareth's Shakespeare one and the Lazarus thingamajiggy. So I had the three scripts and that was kind of it. And yeah, I think I was entirely working off that in terms of Martha. And I think that was my only way in. And yeah, that was interesting to try to get a handle on this character just on the scripts.
I suppose you'd have had Freema's voice, though, given that she'd been in Doomsday.
Yeah, absolutely.
Season, so you could, that absolutely. Would help you.
Absolutely, yeah. So there was that, and so it wasn't entirely... And I'd done that in TV terms before, at least in terms of, you know, being given character notes well before you've ever seen them. Because I know from television and indeed from Doctor Who, but it's much easier to write for somebody once you've really got used to them or seen them. Even though, as we have discussed before, that doesn't always guarantee great results. But from the writer's perspective, at least, you know, you can still make mistakes and get it wrong. But, you know, having worked on the soaps for a number of years, you know, being presented with a new character and you've got to hit the ground running and write for them irrespective of the fact that they've not, maybe the role's not even been cast yet. So I'm kind of used to it. That's what it was. It was great to see this. Very exciting to see the scripts in advance. You know, and it's, frankly, it was one of the because I think a little bit later on when I was writing for the Doctor Who Adventures, the comic strips for that, I think I was hauled up to Cardiff and got to see some Gary got me to watch some episodes. So, I mean, that whole sense of you know, and I'd never had a script before with my name watermarked over it, so that if there was a leak, you know, they knew who to come to. So naturally, apart from, I don't even think I let my kids watch it. Read it. I think I just waved it at them and said, "Look, here's some scripts for Doctor Who that's not even been on yet." And I thought, I'm not even gonna do any more than that than read it myself. But it's tremendously exciting. The whole writing Wooden Heart, if and for no other reason than Doctor Who was back on the screen, was just so exciting, and I was so happy to do it. And you know, getting these scripts, or later on getting to see some episodes, some rough cut episodes in Cardiff. You know, I mean, that's fantastic for a Doctor Who fan. That just doesn't get any better than that.
I can imagine. I'm jealous. So how did you find capturing the Doctor's voice, given that, you know, this is a Doctor, there's, you know, the old chaps and my boys and my dear, all that is long gone.
Yeah.
We've got something, particularly with David Tennant's rapid fire delivery as well.
Yeah. Well, all I can say is, to use that dread term, I lent into it. I lent into what I knew of the Doctor's character, which obviously one had seen by that point. And I haven't reread Wooden Heart since, but I seem to recall, if anything, I go quite over the top. So in the introduction, I'm almost, in fact, I think it is. I think it's a very over the top version of David Tennant, but I almost felt I had to do that to get the character really sorted. And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed writing for that Doctor, for David Tennant. And I think I did an okay job on that one. You know, I was very happy with, there's not mannerisms, but I mean, I don't think I used any of his sort of any of his catchphrases or anything, but I kind of think he's a good Doctor to write for. And it is, although it's all about the delivery. You know, we were talking about Patrick Troughton not that long ago, and again, a lot of David Tennant is the delivery, but you can see it on the page as well, in a way that perhaps you can't with the second Doctor. So yeah, it was good fun, and I think the excitement and enthusiasm, I hope, of writing for Doctor Who, because obviously I'd never written for Doctor Who while it was on television before. I hope that comes through, and certainly it fed into the, just the sheer excitement and fun of writing for that character. I hope it all fed through. Martha, to be honest, a bit trickier. Not sure I entirely got to grips with her, and but there you go. But I like to think the David Tennant Doctor comes across.
It definitely does. It's the rapid fire. You can hear David just going through the words and really quickly in the way that he does, which is fab. Now, how did you find the creating your own characters part for this? Particularly, I'd imagine that Jude is in there as a sort of an identification point for the younger readers.
Yes. I think maybe that was even encouraged to make it. Or certainly it seemed natural to have that sort of character who happens to be younger, but it can be a good character through whom the audience, the readership in this case, see the world and interact with the Doctor and all the goings on. So yes, the characterization, the characters in general, it was a really odd one because they're supposed to be archetypes in many ways. The whole point of what's going on here is that there's kind of a boiling down of myths, and then out of this you get the archetypes. And so a lot of them are supposed to be archetypes, and then it's tricky not to make them ridiculously cliched, but also still have that sort of underpinning. So you've got the wise woman, and you've got the village leader, and you've got... So that was interesting. And even more perhaps than the characters, although there is this sort of archetype thing going on, it affected the plotting, because if I recall correctly, I only plotted the first half of the novel and I sent it to Justin, and that was fine. That's what the commission was based on. So I got to about halfway through writing it, and then I didn't know how the story was going to end. But because it was a story based on archetypes, I wasn't worried. So I just... It was almost like, you know, that whole sort of Joseph Campbell thing going on. And so every morning I would start writing and think, well, what should happen next? And so the entire second half of the novel is literally what should happen next in a mythic kind of point of view. And that obviously feeds into the characters and so on. So yeah, so it was good fun. And I remember odd little things happening, like, I can't remember what the character name is now, but when the wise woman appears at some
point. Dazai.
Yeah, the Dazai. She appears there purely because I knew that mythically she had to. And then I had to work out, well, how on earth has she got to this place that the Doctor has just spent ages going through shark-infested waters to reach the island. It just felt right. And so it was a very interesting experience, both writing those characters and finishing off that storyline, leaning into the myths, yeah.
Yeah, and the fact you've got, you know, the battling brothers, and then there's the element of the who's the father of the child as well, which adds to, I mean, I suppose that's something that's quite, I'm surprised it's not been done in TV almost, to an element. It's something you'd imagine would and probably could be still be done.
Yeah, I suppose. I've completely forgotten about that, actually. I suppose, again, I'm just leaning into my kind of that slightly soapy, dramatic part of my brain. And essentially, it's got to be more than just, you know, a story about monsters, although I wanted there to be lots of strange creatures in this. And yeah, just to almost as simple as just to give every person in it something else, even though they eventually all discover that they're created, they're invented, they're fictional people, to just give each character something else, and things to discover. And it's just standard writing, isn't it, that you're trying to, often you're not trying to sort of overdo it, but you're trying to make sure that nothing is, but where you end up is not necessarily where you started, that things are revealed, but there are things to uncover. Otherwise, you've got a very flat and straightforward structure.
There's the moment where the Doctor and Martha are leaving, just as everything's sort of retracting and compressing as the ship goes into night mode. And then you've got that wonderful moment of Martha running back. And it's one that can just, it's so visual, you could just really imagine it. And particularly David's playing with that and just sort of, Martha!
Yeah.
And I think it's a wonderful sort of cliffhangery moment.
Yeah. I think, again, a lot of it just comes back to the fact that it was back on TV again. So all the sort of slightly more, hopefully not pompous, but slightly more literary kind of things I was doing with, you know, in Sleep of Reason or whatever, because it was back on the screen and primarily you're engaging with Doctor Who again as a televisual thing, as an exciting, family-friendly, you know, adventure series.
Yeah, it definitely comes
out. That's in your mind, and therefore that then comes, I hope, on the page as well. You know, it's a completely different type of, in some ways, you're essentially novelizing something that was never made. You know, you're back at that, and I don't wish to imply that one is better or worse than the other, but you're back at that type of writing. You know, it's more like writing a missing adventure. It's more like, because you're literally trying to just do a book that could maybe have been, you know, certainly scripted and perhaps was chucked out because there wasn't the budget there or whatever. You know, you're really pulling on those kind of, hopefully at least, that sort of excitement and the straightforward thrill of hopefully a well-crafted adventure novel.
Yeah, and I think there's that, you bring in that almost the quest element later on with Martha when they're on that way to the island, which fraught with danger and really enjoyable. That was another bit that I did remember from my first reading all those years ago.
And two things that literally have just struck me as you said the word quest. I now remember what the other one that I pitched to Justin at the same time was, and that was a very much a proper quest story that was kind of based on, you know, my memories as a child of watching Monkey, the Japanese adaptation of the Chinese Buddhist quest classic. And it was very much more, I think there was a literal quest. And for whatever reason, Justin went with this one, but there's still that, and as I say, because I'm playing with the idea of myth and story a bit. And also the way they get that particular sequence with the, I think they're shark-like creatures attacking the boat. I learned a lot from Justin because he got me to, I think, possibly both these things. I think he got me to add that bit in the first place. And then secondly, I think I did a version of that, which was a bit, the language was a bit long and a bit cumbersome. And he said, you know, this is supposed to be an exciting thing. Keep your sentences short. I mean, it sounds so straightforward, but such good advice. And so I rewrote it and I rewrote it and I tried to make it. I'm not very good always at keeping my sentences short, but I thought, no, he's right. This is an action sequence. Let's try and put this across. So yeah, I remember writing that sequence quite well because I was trying to learn and trying to you know, change my style, if I have a style, a little bit, and just think, yeah, this is action. This is, you know, this is supposed to be to the point and exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. It definitely came across, and I enjoyed reading it again. And it's funny how it's like one of those things that stick in the mind, and there is. And then, of course, we get to the conclusion, and we get pretty much, and everybody lives.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, you know, to what extent is that a thing in New Who? Is that a thing in particularly Stephen Moffat's stories? It's kind of something that perhaps I was only aware of looking back now, you know, that you think, oh yeah, of course, you know, nobody dies. But it just seemed to fit the story, and it seems to fit the way that Doctor Who is, or rather was at that point, and to be fair, still is, you know. But yeah, how lovely to write in it, you know, because I killed quite a few people in the past, in fictional people, please point out, in previous Doctor Who works. So yeah, to have something where, you know, there is a literally a happy ending was just great fun.
So what did you think of the cover when you saw that?
But the cover was great. Yeah. Yeah. Not quite sure why David Tennant seems to be having a bit of the old guyliner going on, but no, it's a smashing image. It was lovely to see a photograph of, as again, we just come back to a photograph of the current Doctor, you know, a Doctor who's actually on television on the cover of your book. And it gave me an excuse to go up to, one time I went to the BAFTA Television Awards, and it gave me an excuse to go up to David Tennant and say hello and say your face is on the cover of this particular novel, because he didn't do the audiobook, but you know, it gave me an excuse to say hello. So no, I love the cover. It feels right. Not quite sure. Again, you know, you can quibble. Why is the child seems to be pretty contemporary in terms of their clothing? I don't know, but yeah. And most of all, I've never had a book of mine in Tesco before. So to actually be able to wander into our big local Tescos and see my book, see my little name and a, you know, wonderful picture of David Tennant and Freema on the front. Yeah, just so exciting. Really exciting.
Yeah. You mentioned there the talking book, which is narrated by Adjoa Ando.
Yes.
And yeah, which is a real treat. And I remember when we were having lunch last year, you mentioned that Joe Lidster had done this pretty quickly.
Yes, the poor so-and-so had to reduce, however, let's say it's 50,000 words, I can't remember. But he had to basically reduce it by 50%. And he was probably just chopping, he probably didn't have time to read it in advance, so he's probably just chopping stuff as he went, and fair play to him. So yes, the audiobook is a brilliant, but also abridged. And yeah, it's a, I mean, she is obviously a superb actress, and she does such a good job on the audiobook. My only slightly amusing thing is that, because I think, I can't remember which character is it? Anyway, I think the first character that she has to narrate has an Eastern European name. So again, because, you know, an audiobook reader doesn't have time to necessarily read all this stuff in advance and think it through. So therefore, in the audiobook, I think all the characters have speak with a slight Eastern European inflection, which just kind of amuses me, because the whole point is, you know, the names come from everywhere, the the monsters are sort of aggregated from everywhere. The story is kind of, anyway, it's just very amusing. But yeah, so lucky to have such a great actor reading the audio, and so pleased that I didn't have to try and chop it in half. Poor old Joe did.
Oh, that's been brilliant. Martin, thank you so much for chatting about us and sharing your memories of Wooden Heart.
Thank you very much.
Big thanks to Martin for taking the time to have a chat. Always appreciated. And hopefully we'll be hearing more from him soon. In fact, we know we will be, because he just mentioned it, because we're going to be chatting about his missing adventure, The Menagerie, in the near future. Not the super near future, but the very near future. So let's pop over to see what Doctor Who magazine had to say about it. Wooden Heart was released in the first wave of novels featuring Martha, along with Sting of the Zygons and The Last Dodo. And here's what the DWM review by Matt Michael had to say. Wooden Heart begins well, with the creepy disappearance of children from a lonely village, surrounded by a forest inhabited by hostile monsters, which are moving ever closer to the settlement. Meanwhile, the Doctor and Martha arrive on a deserted and corpse-littered spaceship in the distant future. A ship that suddenly seems to have a door leading into the forest. How and why these two environments are connected forms the core of this book. There's something a bit M. Night Shyamalan about Wooden Heart. Not just the fairy tale atmosphere or the obvious nods to his film The Village, but the clever me use of symbolism and the final twist in the tale. When this works, as in the gripping sequence of characters racing against time through the woods as something comes after them, or the return of the ghostly figures of the children, it makes for some truly powerful and memorable passages. However, these incidents punctuate some rather soggy stretches where the Doctor and Martha discuss their theories or grasp at the latest weird occurrence. Weakest of all is the denouement, which, given the laid-on lead-up, takes about one page to resolve. The book certainly feels very different from the other two, taking a more measured and thoughtful approach and focusing as much on the emotions of the villagers as on the Doctor and Martha. As such, other than reiterating Martha's bravery or the Doctor's cleverness, Wooden Heart doesn't add much to the relationship. Tellingly, the Doctor is a lot more subdued here than he was in Sting of the Zygons or The Last Dodo, as though even he recognises the essential seriousness of Martin Day's story. Possessing gravitas and some stylish prose, in some ways Wooden Heart is the strongest of these books, but lacking their sense of fun or excitement, it's certainly the hardest to love. I will respectfully disagree with my friend Matt, as I thought it was a great read, very gripping, it was a proper page-turner, and there's definitely some great fun in there. However, I'm afraid that the mention of the words M. Night Shyamalan makes me go, no, dreadfully overrated director. Not a fan of his work at all. Every time I've seen one of his films, I've guessed the twist, particularly The Village. I saw that in the cinema. I remember saying that to the person I was with. This is happening in the present day. And yes, I was absolutely right. Oh, sorry if I've just spoiled it for you. Anyway, enough of that. That is Wooden Heart. So, until next week, I've been Kenny Smith, and as always, we do like to play out with a tune, and so, given that this story's Wooden Heart, it seems rather obvious, you know me, Pet Shop Boys fan, yep, let's go with that surprise 1988 number one, Heart. Every time.